Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We are broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm your co-host, Fanny Crawford.
And I'm your other co-host, Stasi Okowski.
And today is Monday, October 21st. I want to start by thanking Andy Offit Irwin for his original composition that you just heard, Tarry Here. Thanks, Andy, for letting us use that as our opening today.
And his voice, too, because he sings it better than we do.
Well, yep. Yeah, he does most things better than we do related to storytelling, but we're not bad.
I don't think he's as good a listener as we are.
He doesn't get as much opportunity because he's telling and singing and playing all the time.
Right.
I wanted to start by talking a bit about all of the storytelling stuff that's been going on in the past week. I have been to several things myself. I know that you've been to some story events, and there's just a lot going on in the region. So yesterday, Sunday, I was at Lovely Lane Methodist Church in Baltimore, downtown, well, not down downtown, but near downtown Baltimore, for the Griot Circle of Maryland, their annual Love Fest, their love story session. And I just had the best time there. I heard five wonderful tellers and really funny stories, really moving stories, all about different forms, different love relationships and love in general. And it was a packed house. There were a lot of people there. I think probably close to 100 people. I mean, in the audience were some amazing storytellers, but the tellers that were actually on stage for this event were Brother Bob Smith, Bob the Griot, who did a medley of love poems that were just amazing. He was really funny. The theme was, I'm not even going to talk about the details because I can't do him justice, but he was really good. Mama Cherry Love did a really moving set about children and mother-child love. She called it 40 Years to Life and Anything for Your Love, about a daughter and a son. Brother Charles Johnson, the title of his work was Love Is, and I had never heard Brother Charles before, so I was moved by his story as well. Baba Simba Malik did an adaptation of Oscar Brown Jr. doing The Ladies' Man. And I've heard a lot of Oscar Brown Jr., but I'd never heard The Ladies' Man before, and it was quite a hoot. He had an audience in stitches. And then Janice Curtis Green brought down the house for the final piece called Break Up to Make Up. And everything that you might imagine from that title, Break Up to Make Up, was in that set. And I always think of Janice Curtis Green as being so polished and so dignified and elegant and just owning the room with her experience and study and knowledge of storytelling and tackling weighty topics and knowing traditional stories as well as historical pieces. Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman and all the important events of the civil rights movement, and she just cracked up the whole house. She said things in that church that I would never have expected to come out of that woman's mouth. And yet there she was talking about breaking up to make up. So you can hear more about that if you call me or email me. It was a wonderful evening, or afternoon and evening. Stosh, you wanted to talk about what's been happening in the storytelling world.
Well, on Saturday, the Antietam Storytelling Guild at Hagerstown Public Library, I like it, they always say the Washington County Free Library, and I guess that's important. I've only known of one library that wasn't free, and then that was like in Jefferson's house or something. I don't know. Anyway, we had Adam Booth perform at 3:30 in the afternoon. We had a very nice audience, and Adam told two of his, I would say two of his best stories. However, all of Adam's stories are exceptional as far as I'm concerned.
They are. And he absolutely
told Jesse's Doll, which I'm going to tell sometime, even if I have to do it in a room by myself, because I would like to try some of the things that Adam did with that. And also, he told Ashton, which I've heard before, and which he performed at Jonesboro 3 years ago and received an incredible standing ovation at the end of that 1 hour story. And that's not easy to do in Jonesboro, Tennessee, you know, not to get 1,500 people up off their feet.
That was an historic telling.
Sure was. Sure, it was just incredible. And Adam did a wonderful job. And it was an event sponsored by the Antietam Storytelling Guild. And I'm really happy about that because it's our first event where we hired someone of Adam's status.
Yes.
And so, anyway, something to be proud about for all the members of the guild.
That was a great afternoon. I really enjoyed. Really, there were fun people in the audience. It was and some new faces.
Right.
That was good too. And so, it seems to me there was one other story event, but I guess that will come to me, and we can talk about that later. Do you want to go right into a story? Do you have a story you want to share? Oh, we didn't talk about the theme.
We should talk about the theme.
Well, all I know about the theme is that it is disasters. And I know that there's all kinds of connotations and connections and synapses that start firing when you say that title. So we'll see what happens today.
And so I do have a story. I have a couple of stories about impending disasters or almost disasters. And I was trying to think if there was ever did I ever have a disaster in my life? But if I was ever involved in a disaster personally and I didn't survive, I wouldn't be able to talk about it. So obviously I'm here. So in my very first stage production in Frederick, Maryland, in 1994, I was a cast member in a production of Camelot. And I had performed in that same show and done the same role a few years before that in Westminster, Maryland. And I was fortunate that I was able to do this show. And in the show, I played the old king, King Pellinore, who is a comical person, was always chasing after a beast. And I got to wear some pretty neat costumes. And I had a sword that I wore. I never drew the sword on stage, which is good, because accidents could happen like that. And that might be a disaster, but I had the sword that I have owned for many years, and it's a sword I bought at an antique shop, and I have a very wide leather belt that I have the sword attached to in its scabbard. And the night before the opening of the show, actually two nights before the opening of the show, we had a Wednesday rehearsal, and Friday was opening. And at the Wednesday rehearsal, it was a dress rehearsal. And at one point, I didn't go on stage for about the first 40 minutes of the show, almost the entire first act. But then when I do go on, it was a funny scene. And when I leave, everyone's kind of laughing and having a good time at the expense of the character, because he's kind of a doddering guy, but very lovable. And I walked off stage, off to the wings on stage right, and it was pitch black. This is at the Weinberg Center. In most of the productions there, if you leave the stage, you have to be very careful and know which way to go and what you're doing, because being in bright lights on the stage and then walking off, you go into total darkness, even though there are a few little lights on. And it takes a while. It took me a number of times to practice walking off and standing still in the dark, and then being able to decide where to go. Well, I walked off and started towards a doorway on the back wall, which led downstairs to the green room, where you put on your makeup and change clothes and all this. And as I headed towards that, one of the backstage workers, we had all kind of names for those guys, but they were really more important than some of the actors at times, walked past me, and so I moved slightly to my right. And when I did, there was a change in the backdrop, a thing called a drop. A drop or a backdrop is a painting on a large piece of canvas that covers the entire back wall of the stage. And it's called a backdrop because what it does is it has a scene painted on it of some kind. It might be a forest scene, or it might be buildings or something. And it's called a drop because it can be lowered from way above the stage up near the ceiling of the theater, and it can be drawn back up. Normally there are maybe four or five different drops in a big production. Just as I got past the right-hand corner of that drop, it was being raised because the scene was changing. And all of a sudden, I felt a strange thing. I was off my feet, and it was almost as if someone had pushed me and I fell off my feet, but I wasn't really falling. I was being lifted up. The pipe, which is in a sewn pocket at the bottom of the drop, it's a metal pipe that goes the entire width of the stage, and that pipe is really heavy, and it holds the drop so that the canvas is nice and stiff and doesn't ripple. So I was actually being lifted up in the air. The pipe sticking out of the end of that drop had come up as they were erasing it, and it had hooked into the bottom of the thick leather belt I had on, and I was not exactly flying, but I was floating upwards, and I had no idea of what was happening, But all of a sudden there was a commotion, and I could see that now I was a good 4 or 5 or 6 feet off the ground and moving quickly. The drops in some places are done by hand, pulleys, ropes and pulleys, backstage workers are pulling, and some of them are done by machine, by a motor that's in the basement someplace and is attached to the pulleys and can lift it. Anyway, thanks to a person by the name of Bill, who is a wonderful friend of mine and one of my favorite people in the whole world, as I went past his eyes, he jumped up and grabbed me by the ankles. Now, Bill is probably 5'11 or maybe 6 feet, a rather big, strong man. And he came a little bit off the floor also as I was being raised. But he was strong enough that he did kind of, later he told me this is what happened, he kind of pulled himself up by my ankles and then let his arms real loose without leaving, letting go of the grip on my ankles. So he almost did like a pull-up using my ankles to hold on to and then let himself drop down without letting go of my ankles. And that sudden jerk caused the pipe to rip out of the drop. So there was this sound of across the stage, and the pipe slammed down on one side, and I slammed down to the left, knocking Bill off his feet. And luckily, I was still standing, and Bill didn't get hurt. He just got stumbled around a bit. Everything stopped, lights came up, and people were running around yelling things like, "What was that? Did you see that? He was up in the air. He was flying." And when it settled down and we were able to look at the situation, someone said I was 15 feet in the air. I think my head might have been 15 feet in the air. My feet were lower than that. And certainly because Bill probably could reach up to about 7 or 8 feet. And he had me by the ankles. Anyway, it was such a great commotion. And I have been thankful every day to Bill because if he hadn't done that, I think the pipe would have eventually ripped out of the bottom of that drop, but it would have probably taken a few more feet with me dangling on it, because if it hadn't been for him grabbing my ankles and holding on, I would have been kind of in a lower position. My head would have been down, my feet would have been up, and I would have been maybe in a position like flying through the air, like Superman or something, not on purpose. So,
what a story.
And it caused quite a bit of panic because the stage manager and the director had to call New York and get another drop because that drop couldn't be repaired by anyone in our theater company. It needed a special kind of person to sew the bottom of that the right way. And so on Friday morning, there was an airmail delivery to at the airport in Baltimore, and one of the workers went down to Baltimore, picked up the drop, and they brought it back, and the show went on. So,
what a story. That could have been a
real disaster.
Disaster with fatalities.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, anyway, good friend Bill. And actually, there are people who I've known in the theater community there who, if you mention, do you remember something happening backstage during dress rehearsal. Like, oh yeah, that's when Stosh was flying. So, a great bit of fun afterwards talking about it. Not so much fun, and I bet it didn't last 10 seconds or more, maybe 10 or 12 seconds, something like that. But it was exciting.
Well, you've made it into a fine 10-minute story. So, well, for a 30-second or 10-second event,
right.
That's great. I did remember. Oh, I should tell our listeners that this is the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting in Bolivar, West Virginia, and I'm Fanny Crawford,
and I'm Stacy Okalski,
and we're happy you've joined us. The other storytelling event that I thought about was, didn't you go to hear Mark Brew tell stories this week?
Yes, and this was the third year Mark has done this at the Roarback Inn
in Sharpsburg,
which happens to be only about a 2-minute walk from my house. On Wednesday evening, I was able to walk up the street, go to the inn, and there was an audience of about, I guess, 20, 25 people. And Mark Brew told stories about strange things that happened in Sharpsburg. And especially one of them that was concentrated in the building, in the inn. And it was a wonderful, wonderful, scary tale about someone coming to the inn during the Civil War, and they were after a horse. And they came in the night and were willing to kill in order to get this horse. So Mark did a beautiful job of relating the story, pointing out different places in town. And since I lived there, it was easy, and it's a very small town, it was easy to follow the story right up to the stair steps that they used to go upstairs to the bedroom where the man who had the horse, who owned the horse, was shot and killed. And the best part of the evening after that, I was the first person to leave. People were staying around. They had some refreshments. But when I went out of the inn and stood on the sidewalk of Main Street in Sharpsburg, and I could look towards the corner of Mechanic and Main, on the side of the street where I was, I was on the south side of the street. It was eerie. It was dark. It was chilly. There were not many street lights on that side of the street, because that side of the street has a lot of trees along the edge. And in some other parts of Main Street, there aren't many trees at all. So there was very little light on the sidewalk. The trees were moving because it was very windy. So windy, it blew over the bony horse that was sitting up on the grass to the right of the inn.
I've seen that bony horse.
Right. And when I got home, I told my wife, if I was had a video camera, I would try to shoot a scene that very night, right there. I would have walked down that sidewalk and made a film of it, even though there was no one in it and talking, because it would have made a great, great video for something like Halloween. I truly was kind of chilled until I got down to the corner and could turn and go to my house, which is just a few feet off, about 50 feet from the corner there. Anyway, it was kind of weird, you know. It was like I thought to myself, if I were a lot younger, I would have been running.
Oh, and this is
that kind of a feeling.
Stosh, the scientist, speaking.
That's right. It was definitely a, I guess maybe my scientific bent kept me calm enough to walk down there without running. Though I really was tempted. If someone had said boo behind me, I probably would have dropped dead.
Well, I'm glad that didn't happen.
I am too. I am too.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, are we ready for another story?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this is one of those stories that is in process, in progress. I'm going to tell this story at the Renaissance Fair in Winchester, Virginia, next Sunday, this coming Sunday. And it probably will be different than this telling, but you can help me with that, Stosh, if you have feedback for me. This is the first draft, and it's I was thinking about developing it for a mixed audience, that, assuming there would be more adults than kids in the audience. There will definitely be children there. But after speaking to the coordinator of the Ravenswood Fair, again, I'm rethinking some of my assumptions, and so I probably want to make this more of a children's or an introduction for kids, but I'm not to that point yet. So any feedback you have for me, either on air or afterwards, doesn't matter to me either way.
Okay,
so this is my introduction to the story set that I'm going to do on Sunday. You may be able to tell from my clothing and the way I say my words a bit differently than you do that I didn't grow up around here. In fact, I come from a place far across the sea. I was born on an island, a bit of land surrounded all round by the sea. It was a medium-sized island, bigger than all of this place you call Winchester. An island bigger than 5 or 10 Winchesters all lined up end to end, but an island all the same. If you got in a boat and sailed the sea all round my island, it would take you days to sail all the way round to the place you started. When I was young, I lived with my parents, my little brother, my grandmother and grandfather, all in the same small house by the seaside. Now, I've always thought of myself as a bit of a mermaid, you know, closely related to the fishes that swam in the sea outside our home. But all my family were fisher folk. We made our living by the sea, taking our small boat out to sea each day that the weather was good, and catching fish in our nets, plenty of fish for us to eat. Enough left over to sell in the market. We collected seaweed, kelp, shells, and driftwood along the beach and sold those in the market as well. We were not rich, but we were not poor either. It was a good life. Now, best of all, my grandmother and grandfather were storytellers. Griots, the keepers of the stories of our people. The leaders of our island, the council, often called my grandmother and grandfather to an island council to ask them questions. They might ask questions about the grandmothers and grandfathers of my grandfather and grandmother, about our ancestors, or sometimes about the animals that shared our island. The sea creatures that swam in the sea around the island with us humans. My grandmother and grandfather remembered the names and great deeds and accomplishments of all the ancestors who'd come before us, and they remembered the mistakes they'd made. Animals and people and plants, even the rocks, had names and stories. Now, some of those stories, my grandma and grandpa had been there to see themselves. Other stories, they remembered because their grandmothers and grandfathers and their great-great-great-grands had been there to see the stories unfold and pass those stories on. Now, my mother and my father were important people on the island because they were good, skilled fisherfolk. They knew where to find the best fish of every species, the best kelp and seaweed, and the most beautiful and useful shells and driftwood. My grandparents were revered even more because they were the keepers of the stories. Every evening, after the fleet was safely back on shore, they often made a fire, and we children sat on the beach round the fire, eating our supper, and then listening to the stories, so that we would know something of our island history and understand how we came to live as we did, where our traditions, where our customs came from. In those days, there was a dry season on the island every year. The freshwater creeks and springs would begin to dry up until they were only a trickle of water, and we had to be careful not to use too much nor waste it. And when we watered our small gardens, we carried the water by hand in buckets at that time of year, instead of opening the water sluices, the clay water pipes, that could carry the water from the springs to the garden. It was faster to water from the garden by opening the sluices and letting the spring water gush downhill and over the plants. But if the spring was just a trickle, we didn't do that, because then we might not have enough water to drink while we waited for the rains to come. The rainy season would come every year with great storms and hurricanes. Creeks and springs would fill with gushing water, and we could use as much water as we liked for the garden, for washing things, for playing in. There was plenty of water then. The storms came out of the western sky, pounding the west side of the island. Our house and the beach that we fished from was on the east side of the island. Everyone who lived on the island had their main house on the east side. Some families fished from the west side and kept their boats in the west during the dry season. But when the storms were due, everyone moved boats and everything else from the west beaches round to the east. We'd get plenty of water from the rains on the east side during the rainy season, but we were protected from the worst of the storms on that side, because the storms were carried by the west wind out of the sea and sky, hitting the island at almost the same place each year. The story keepers, tales about the rain and the storms, always told of the wind and rain coming from the west. When I was 12 years old, all of that changed. That year, when the rains came, the storms were different in a way that no one expected. First, the rains were much later than usual, so the ground was dry, and we had to spend hours every day carrying water in buckets to keep the gardens from shriveling up and dying. And then when the rains did come, they came on the east side with the east wind, with the storms pounding the east side beaches where the houses stood and crashing against the boats moored there. The storms that year were harder and fiercer than any of the stories told, and many houses were destroyed by lightning and tidal surges. Our boat was ripped from its mooring by high winds. It crashed on the rocks a half mile out the inlet, out from the beach. My parents tried to help our neighbor save the few remaining boats, trying to sail them round to the west because that was now the quiet side. My mother and my father drowned in that attempt, as did many others in that terrible time. There were council meetings night after night, And the storykeepers talked long after dark for many weeks, trying to figure out what had made the winds change and how to know which way the next storms would hit. After that, the houses were built differently, high on stilts and only in protected parts of the beaches on both sides of the island, with high rock walls at the inlets to increase the shelter for the boats. No matter which side of the island the storms hit, at least some of the houses and most of the boats would survive. Gardening became more important for food over the next few years, even as the rains took longer to arrive. We carried buckets to keep the gardens going. We worked to build replacement boats, and we had to make do with less fish till we built up the fleet again. I was old enough by then that I was often sent to help other families with gardening and food preparation while the grown-ups were building and repairing boats. I was now spending time with many different families in different gardens and kitchens, learning different and sometimes better ways to preserve our harvests, experimenting with different recipes for the fruits of our gardens and the sea. And as I talked about what I learned, people began to ask me for advice with these things. Oh, I was never the best cook or the fanciest. I just wanted to be sure we were doing the best we could with what we had. You know what a scullery is? That's where the food preparation happens, in a house or a hall. And it's an ancient word. A long, long time ago, it meant the regular food preparation place. But on the island, it often meant the place where the first preparation was done, where the fish were cleaned, where the dirt and sand was washed off the vegetables, and where the buckets were filled with scraps and bits of offal and garbage to feed the pigs. Well, people began to call me the scullery story keeper. The scullery story keeper, and that amused my grandparents no end. The storms did not abate, even after several years, and the council set up cooking houses on higher ground, far from the beaches, so that even when people were working hard on building and repairing boats or sharing gardening chores, there was always a safe place to feed the families. The council asked me to work with the cooks in those high ground kitchens to share what I'd learned, and then I began to write down what I knew, making copies with a quill pen on strips of parchment, new recipes for pumpkin and squash, for fish with corn, fish with tomatoes, and fish with green beans, on and on. The years passed. The storms took our island, bit by bit, carrying sand and earth and then the rock itself into the sea. Families left the island looking for safer, more stable places to build homes and moor the boats. That is how I came to be here in this new world, where even now, some people still call me the scullery story keeper.
Wow. Very nice. Very nice.
Thank you.
I like it. Let's see. I have only one comment.
Okay. Now's a good time. I'm going to write it down.
Right. Okay. Well, there was a lot of description before you said at 12 years old, all of that changed. And that's where the story became really interesting. The first part was very nice. The description was well done. But I was waiting for what's this all about. And as soon as you said that, my mind became more attuned to, oh, now something is going to happen. So I just felt that introduction was a little bit long.
Okay. I'm sure that's true because it's a little longer than I want. The story's sure. A little longer than I want it to be. So that's good advice.
Yeah. So if you could,
move things along.
Move that along, kind of. So I think it might be time to mention something about storytelling that's coming up.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Besides this weekend.
And we should say, this is the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, and we are your co-hosts, Fanny Crawford and
Stacy Okalski. And the Speak Story series, which occurs on the second Tuesday of the month, most months. Coming up is the last event of the year. It's hard to believe that. Especially, I was just realizing that Stories in Around has three more programs. However,
Speak Story series.
it's last one is coming up on November 12th.
Well, that's partly because Speak has already finished October, but Stories in the Night is not. Okay.
It's just one of those things that struck me. How could there be three left and only one left? But anyway, that's just, you know me with the numbers. So, Bill Harley on November 12th, a real favorite of so many people. And favorite of mine. He is one of the best storyteller, singer, entertainers, I think, in the country. He almost always has his guitar in his hands, and he sings and plays some nice tunes while he tells the story. And sometimes he uses kind of popular music, popular probably to older people, but it's some nice ballads and things to emphasize the era he's talking about. That'll be November 12th at Shepherd University in the Reynolds Hall, 7:30.
I will be there.
Right. And if you want to get more information about the Speak Story series, you can go to
www.speakstories.com.
Speakstoriesseries.com. I started to shorten that all the time because I think we're going to do something with the name.
Oh.
We're not going to change it drastically, but I think it's going to be something
slightly different.
Slightly different.
Okay.
So, and I believe that when we can announce the performers for next season, people will be thrilled at every performer that we have coming.
I have no doubt that people will be thrilled. Speak has an excellent record of bringing in the best of the best.
And so does Stories in the Round.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Okay.
Is it time for you to tell another story?
I have another story that, believe it or not, you know how especially storytellers in stories always, or not always, but a lot of times things happen in threes. So I'm going to talk about a time before my flight on the stage. I took another flight. And it was actually much more dangerous, and I'm very lucky that I was here to tell the story. So, in 1975, I was teaching school, and every summer I had to look for work because we didn't get paid during the summer. A friend, I lived in a trailer park, Hill and Dale Trailer Park, in Finksburg, Maryland. And a friend across the little road that went around our trailer park introduced me to a cousin of his, who happened to be the superintendent of a company that was redoing the roadway of the Hanover Street Bridge in Baltimore, Maryland. And so I got a job that summer working on this bridge crew. It was an incredible job. I was the only summer employee. And I got to do all kinds of things on that job. First of all, I got to stand down in the train yard under the bridge where lots of things happened about trains, where they would bring cars in and switch cars, and trains were constantly moving boxcars, rail cars, all kinds of things in and out of that little area. It was also very close to water. So the first part of my summer, I stood under the bridge, not exactly directly under it, but that was down low, and far enough away from the bridge itself so that the people working on the bridge could see me, and I could get their attention waving a red flag when I needed to. And my sole purpose in life for, I think it was about 10 days before they finally decided I could do something better than stand still and wave a flag. But what I would have to do is when a train was coming and was going to be under the bridge, passing under the bridge, I would wave the flag vigorously to get the attention of the people operating machinery, because they were cutting apart the deck of that bridge on one side, and pieces of stuff fell, pieces of concrete and metal and things like that fell. And so we wanted to make sure that the train wasn't hit by anything like that. Once the train safely passed, if anything then was knocked down that fell on the tracks, a couple of the crew members would come and move the stuff off the tracks. That job looked so interesting to me after standing for about 10 days waving a flag, that when they finally had me do something other than wave the flag, I was just thrilled. The company I worked for was doing bridge work in a number of places in Baltimore, and whenever there was a pour, which meant they were going to pour concrete onto a deck that had been set up for it, that meant that, you know, it was clean, everything, rebar, steel rods were interlaced on top of the structure, and then cement was poured on top of that, and the cement would be coming out of trucks. Trucks would back up to the area, dump the cement out of the back end of the truck, the trucks that have the big round barrel turning, and the cement would be poured out of that. And they would always have 6 to 8 people with incredible device, a very long, heavy-duty electric cord attached to a metal thing. It actually looked like a long, smooth thumb, maybe about 2.5 feet long. And what it would do when it was turned on is it would vibrate. And so you would, if you were doing that job, you would stand in that area, cement was being poured down into the prepared area, and as it went around your ankles and everything, you would try to balance yourself on top of the edges and then push that metal thing into the cement, which would vibrate the cement and get it to settle better so that it wouldn't just form bumps and things. Well, every time that happened, it only happened 3 times that summer where I was involved, it was a great day because they would do a pour at about 3:30 to 4 o'clock in the morning. So everybody from the different bridges would go to the place where there's a pour, where they're going to pour a new deck. And there might be as many as 50 people working, doing different things, driving the truck, unloading the cement, vibrating the cement, all kind of things. And you did that. It took only about 2 hours once we got started to finish it. And then, of course, the deck had to sit and dry over a period of time. So we'd work from 3:30 to about 6. And then we had the rest of the day off at full pay, which was incredible. Well, one of the things you had to do after the pour was finished is clean up different things. And there was a device, an electric generator that was used, and a crane would have that suspended above the bridge area, and the wires that were plugged into that generator were the ones that were attached to the metal device, which vibrated. So when it was finished, you would undo the wire, clean the device, and that generator would then be taken away. Well, the generator was hanging in the air so that the electric cords coming from it would not be tangled up in the cement or anything like that. And it would be hanging in the air because there was a crane that was holding it. My job at the end of this pour was to go to that generator, which was now swung over to a part of the deck that wasn't being worked on. The crane operator would lower that generator down onto its wheels, and someone had to stand on a little edge next to that generator and reach up to the top in the middle of that machine and undo the hook. There was a steel cable that came down from the crane, and you had to grab the hook, pull the top towards you, and then slide the hook out of a circle of metal that was used to lift it. And once that was free, you would raise your other hand, wave 3 times, and let go of the hook so that the crane operator could pull it up. I was really excited to get a chance to do that. It was the first time I was going to do it. I hopped up onto the edge of the generator, and it was a little step there, reached up, grabbed hold of the hook, pulled it towards myself so I could slide the pointy part out. And without another blink, I had not done anything except that. No hand, other hand was raised. No signal was given. The crane operator wasn't paying attention. He began to pull the hook up. When he did, the heavy leather gloves I was wearing on my right hand got caught by that hook. And I rose about 15 feet. My feet were about 15 feet above the deck. Luckily, that leather glove ripped and I fell. I got a couple of bruised knees because of the way I hit. In the next few minutes, I watched a man being fired. I was okay. I was shaken. Actually, I was scared to death for a few seconds because I could have fallen on a number of objects that were laying on the ground that would have hurt my poor little Polish body. but the foreman on that job actually called the crane operator, had him turn off the machine, come down, and in the next 10 minutes or so, he was fired and told to leave the job, and he would get his pay in the mail. So
they were glad you weren't dead.
And so was I. That was really scary. Because I could actually, I was looking up. I was trying to slide my hand out of the glove, but I couldn't because the hook had caught it at the back and was holding my hand. And I was going up, and you know, they say your life flashes before your eyes. I felt like I was going to join the angels. So,
were you making noise?
I wasn't. I mean, I didn't scream or anything. I didn't know that I didn't until later.
When someone said,
why didn't you yell? I said, I think I was too busy concentrating on my glove and my hand going up in the air. Because if they had asked me later, I would have said, of course I yelled. But obviously I didn't because they wondered why I didn't.
Wow.
That was very exciting.
That's a very exciting story.
I know. And since things like that happen in threes, I can't wait.
You think you're going to fly again, do
you?
I
don't know. Well, it was 18 years between those two, I guess.
So it's been more than that now.
No, it's 25 years since the second one.
Okay. Well, I will read the newspaper every morning to see what happens.
Yes.
I'm going to take a couple minutes to talk about stories in the round because we are running out of time. So I want everybody to know that Dovey Thomason is our storyteller for October. This evening, October 21st, Dovey Thomason will be here. And if you have not heard Dovey tell stories, you need to be there. She is a Lakota Sioux, Kiowa Apache, and Scots descendant. And she tells stories from all three of those cultural traditions, as well as personal stories. She's shared with me a bit of what she's going to tell tonight, and I'm not going to spoil the surprise. I just want you to know that you need to be there. 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown, 13245 Searfoss Pike. That's a mile west of the city limits, just past the Salem Avenue or Route 58 exit on Route 81. And if you have questions about that session this evening, you can call me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638. You can also email me at Fanitsky, F as in Fanny, A-N-N-Y. I'm sorry, Fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. And I want to tell you really quickly, November 25th, Mitch Capel is our storyteller coming to us from North Carolina. Very, very funny guy, but he's also going to do some serious storytelling, probably including some Paul Lawrence Dunbar pieces, because that's one of the things that Mitch is famous for. And then December 23rd, Fanny Crawford will be our featured storyteller, and she has not told me what she has planned, so I have no idea what she'll be telling.
And since Fanny Crawford's going to be performing, maybe someone else will introduce that night.
Oh, maybe someone will. Would you like to do the introductions?
Oh, I would love to do that.
I would love for you to do that.
That's great.
Because you will hardly do any. You'll just go right into the performance. I know you, Stasz Sokalski.
Yes. It will be the one and only chance to have a brief introduction at Stories in the Round.
All three of those sessions, $10 in advance, $12 at the door. Take us out, Stasz Sokalski.
All right. This is Stasz Sokalski and
Fanny Crawford,
your co-host for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia. Closing out this week's show, this storytelling hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, and I think that describes us. Encouraging and enlisting our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening.